This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Every year, millions of Americans visit the Mall in Washington, D.C. Some come to see the great Smithsonian museums and the memorials, and some come just to be heard.
The Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition.
Martin Luther King, speaking at the March on Washington in 1963, anti-abortion activists at the 25th anniversary at Roe v. Wade, and anti-war activists just this past October. All of these people came to Washington to exercise rights clearly described in the First Amendment: the right to free speech, the right to peaceable assembly, and the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. In other words, they came to protest. Over the next week, Washington will be the site of at least two more protests. On Saturday, anti-war activists will brave cold temperatures to again lodge their opposition to war with Iraq. A few days after that, anti-abortion activists will march and rally on the 30th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. What we're going to talk about for the remainder of this hour is not the pros and cons of war or of abortion, but the act of protest itself. Are you coming to Washington this week? Why? Or why not? Have you ever been to a protest? Have you stopped attending protests? If you don't go to marches and rallies, do you have another way to protest? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California, is Lucy Barber. And she's the author of a new book, Marching on Washington. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Why Washington? How long have people been marching on the Capitol?
Well, people actually didn't start marching right after the First Amendment was drafted and ratified by the Constitution. In fact, Congress, soon after that amendment was passed, started denying people the right to directly petition them. It became too much of a hassle. So the real idea of marching on Washington didn't get created and even indeed tested until 1894, when a group called Coxey's Army actually walked from Ohio to Washington and staged a demonstration in the Capitol.
And governments have always been uncomfortable with the idea of thousands of their citizens in the streets, as sometimes peaceable protests can turn more violent than that. Yet the history of political protest in Washington, it's not been, there certainly has been some violence, but there's been a lot more protest.
In the sense of
a lot more peaceable protest than violence. It has not really ever turned particularly ugly.
Well, there's been times when it's been pretty ugly. In 1932, and the veterans marching to win an early payment of their bonus.
Of course, the bonus
got driven out by the army. That wasn't pretty. And in 1971. Just after I actually went to a march, another set of protesters, 12,000 people, got arrested pretty summarily and put into jail for being in Washington. They violated a number of laws and probably appropriately were arrested, but 12,000 people arrested over 3 days, I think, is still a U.S. record for mass arrests. So Washington hasn't always been the peaceful site, but it is true that over time we have come to associate Washington with this image of a peaceful, large march on Washington. And it seems like, as I argue in my book, a political tradition now, whereas in the past it wasn't the case.
Well, a lot of people would say that it's more effective to organize locally.
I think that's always, there's a place for organizing locally. I've definitely taken part in organizing locally and protesting locally, but I think that there is something uniquely democratic about coming to your capital and speaking as the people of the nation in the capital spaces. It's extremely inspiring for people who take part of it. It provides a focus for people to look at a cause, to say, those citizens care enough to go to the Capitol. It changes the nature of your case. Some cases, you're not going to go to Washington if you want the zoning law changed.
Right.
But you're going to go to Washington if you want to stop a war, if you want to change federal abortion policy. There's times where it's right.
Our phone number again, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's go to Jim, who's on the line with us in Grafton, New Hampshire.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Very good. As a Vietnam veteran, two tours, 13 months combat, I firmly believe that in the United States of America in particular, the civilian population has every right to protest in a peaceful and legal manner and abide by the laws. And when that's done, if they do it in a proper and legal manner, they get their point across more effectively than if they were to, you know, like the terrible situations that we had back in the 60s and the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd hate to see that reoccur again, particularly if we go to war.
It's interesting you say that. If you were a Vietnam vet, obviously a lot of those protests were, in a way, against you.
Well, I volunteered for Vietnam, you know, and all the right things.
Mm-hmm.
And the right things were, you know, the Constitution of the United States and freedom of speech. And like I said, as long as we have our, as long as we follow through with the proper and legal and peaceful manners to protest, then that is a really good way to exercise our freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank.
While I was in Vietnam, saw a lot of bad things, and you know, I really couldn't blame the people back here for protesting the war. It really got out of hand.
A lot of vets, though, didn't appreciate the way they were treated when they came home.
Well, you know, I explained that to the person who handles your phone, and the worst experience I had was I pulled two tours, 13 months combat, and on my way through Seattle, on my way home after my first extension tour, I was spit on in Seattle at the airport, and I was in my dress greens. I was so embarrassed, you know. And I really had a grudge. I really carried a grudge for the next, you know, year and a half after that, you know. But, you know, honestly, looking back, you know, I think the American people were entitled to protest a war that, where, you know, 58,000, 60,000 American boys were killed.
Yeah. Looking back, how do you feel about being spat upon?
I still resent them two girls. I really do. I really do. I'll never get over that.
I can understand.
You know, I mean, I had my uncle served in Chosun Reservoir in Korea. I had three uncles that served as Marines in the Pacific Theater during World War II. And they never experienced anything like that. But all in all, I'm pretty proud of my service in Vietnam.
Well, Jim, thanks very much.
Well, thank you, sir. You have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
One of the things I think about that moment of Vietnam protest was that it was some of the reasons that people's passions got strong enough that they would do such really extraordinarily outrageous things to individuals like Jim, who was just calling, is because protesting in a way went on for so long that a lot of people got quite frustrated with using the peaceful march on Washington as a tool. You have organizers at that time just saying, forget it, don't do this anymore. Indeed, when I grew up, that was pretty much the kind of politics I was surrounded by, that, you know, marches are a waste of time. You've got to do something more direct. You've got to be right there in the trenches. It's not enough anymore. But that's because it was a long war, and people protested from 1961 to 1973 against the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. And I think that gives a different tenor to how people feel about the effectiveness of marching on Washington.
Now let's hear from Jonathan, who's on the line with us from Amherst, Massachusetts.
Yes, hi, how you doing? I was actually born in Washington, D.C., and I've attended many demonstrations in Washington, D.C. My feeling, though, is that large demonstrations like the one that's coming up this Saturday don't appeal to me anymore, and it's not because I don't feel passionately about the issue, but it's about the nature of the message. There have been times when large demonstrations have been very effective because there's a cohesive, very clear message. And one that I would just like to mention that many of your listeners might remember, I was living in D.C. at the time in 1981 when the AFL-CIO put on a demonstration called Solidarity Sunday, in which they, or maybe it was on a Saturday, they bought out the whole metro system, and the metro system was free for the day, and they had about 500,000 people. And it was in response to Reagan's firing of the air traffic controllers, but it was a very labor-oriented demonstration, and it had a very high level of cohesiveness and dignity and humility and cohesion. And what I find in the broad-based coalition-type anti-war things, and particularly in the issue in 1991 on the Gulf thing, I was at one in San Francisco, and what I imagine will happen in D.C. is that it attracts the extremists. And I saw in the one that happened in October, I was watching it on C-SPAN, and there were some outrageously extremist people who were invited to speak. And the message, what I believe the message, I would march in a demonstration where the message was very clear that the war in Iraq is a diversion from the necessary war on terrorism. But when it becomes this thing of, like, you know, blame America first, where it becomes this thing of, like, completely ignoring the reality of what we're in, and where the message becomes, you know, a range of opinions that is from the wacko left to a liberal mainstream, you know, realistic opinion, it loses any kind of coherence and cohesion, and it doesn't become a dignified experience. Hello?
Yeah, I was just going to ask Lucy Barber for a response. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, first off, I grew up in Amherst, so hi.
Oh, <good.
laughs> Nice to hear from someone else from my hometown.
Yeah,
and,
I've only been here 5.5 years, but it's a great town.
Okay. Yeah, but I think that issue of coherence is one of a real challenge for marches today. One of the things that I think has really enshrined the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, the clip that we heard from at the beginning from Martin Luther King,
right,
is that they really put a big effort on trying to make it coherent. And to limit how long, to have only a few speakers,
right,
to have a really strong message. This, of course, was dismaying to activists at different extremes, but on the other hand, it did make the march have a real strong feeling at the time and to last in history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in contrast, it seems like, and you could see it starting as in the anti-war marches, really in against the Vietnam War. And since then, the emphasis has been on inclusion,
mm-hmm,
to include as many different people in your march. And this has, like you say, has the effect of often making marches seem almost incoherent in terms of what their final message is.
Yeah, and a lack of discipline and a lack of dignity, I feel, you know, in terms of the feeling at the march.
Yeah, and of course I think this is a place where you have to have some compromise between how tightly you control it and how much you let people express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in 63, the organizers didn't want anybody to carry homemade signs.
Mm-hmm.
They told people they all had to use the same sign.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that gave them coherence, but on the other hand, I think part of marching on Washington also does include your right to have your own sign that says your particular take on it. Now, some of them are going to be outrageous,
right,
but I wasn't comfortable with that sense of let's control the message that much to the level of each individual.
Well, Jonathan, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. And Lucy Barber, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Lucy Barber is the author of Marching on Washington, and she's joined us from the studios of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joining us now from his office in Irvine, California, is David Meyer. He teaches sociology and political science at UC Irvine, and he's the co-editor of the Social Movement Society. And thank you for joining us today.
It's Thanks, Neil.
So why do people get involved in protest?
People protest because they think it's necessary for them to do it to get what they want, and they think that their protest might actually make a difference. This means that people who protest are people who are unlikely to win otherwise. So you don't see the rich people's march on Washington to cut tax on dividends. You don't, do they? I mean, they found another way of getting it done, right?
It was a very quiet march if they had one.
Yeah, and so if you think that your participation is necessary to get something and that it might work, then you're more likely to protest.
Does the way people protest, does that vary from issue to issue?
Sure, but a lot of tactics become staples in the arsenal of democratic protest politics. So the anti-abortion protesters borrowed their tactics from the civil rights movement, and the sit-down strike, which the civil rights movement used to great effect, comes from the labor movement. So something that works is going to be copied.
And here's an email question we got from Orland in Boulder, Colorado. Do protests really work? Are minds really changed, or is this an activity, a waste of time for participants?
Oh, protests definitely work, but activists usually don't get what they ask for or what they want. That doesn't mean they don't work. For example, President Bush deciding to go to the UN to justify the war in Iraq, which still seems on the horizon, mm-hmm. is a direct response to political dissent in the United States. Does that mean the war will be stopped? I don't know. But does that mean the protest didn't matter? Of course it mattered. If you reread Martin Luther King's speech from the 1963 demonstration, have we gotten all those things that he asked for? No. Has the world changed around us? Sure.
Now, can you give us some definitions of terms? I mean, we tend to use march, rally, protest, all interchangeably. Are there any differences?
March, rally, demonstration are technical terms that everybody employs differently, and it's not particularly helpful to, you know...
Go into the definitions.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. And they can be permitted or non-permitted. And there can be there can be civil disobedience, which is a different category of protest.
Sure.
March on Washington, rally at Washington, demonstration, they're all similar. March usually involves moving somewhere, actual motion.
Sure. Though it's up and down the mall sometimes. But anyway,
yeah.
There's also the ones that end with the word in, and I guess teach-in was the first one of those.
Teach-in, sit-in, then there were die-ins. I'm blanking on others. Speak-outs.
Be-ins there were, but that was sort of another thing entirely.
Speak-outs, talk-out. Yeah, but I mean, that's not really the important point to get across. The important point to get across is people protest because of political claims, and the way to understand what's going on is to look at institutional politics at the same time. It's a mistake to see protest as something other than an extension of the same kind of politics that everybody else is engaged in.
We're talking about protest after the break. We'll hear from organizers of the weekend rallies coming up. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, we're talking about the protest in American society and in your life. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from her office in Washington, D.C. is Nellie Gray, president of the March for Life. She's busy planning a march for next week. We know you're busy. Thanks for taking time for us today.
Thank you for inviting us.
How do you prepare for this event?
You begin by deciding what it is you want to do, and then the people decide whether or not they want to come and join you. And what we want to do is overturn Roe versus Wade, and the people, America, is also wanting to do that. When Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court's infamous abortion decision, came down 30 years ago, I think the court and feminist abortionists thought that we might mutter a little bit and then we would go away. But what has happened is we know exactly what needs to be done, which is overturn that decision, and therefore we come together in like mind for the single purpose of just overturning Roe versus Wade.
Have these rallies have been held every year for the past 30 years?
Right.
Have they changed over time?
Well, they change in style a bit, and they change in numbers depending on what the conditions are, but they continue. It's a steady, very steady, solid, determined group of people in America who understand that the intentional killing of innocent preborn children is an offense against our country, God Almighty, and all of us. And we don't want to live side by side with this evil as other countries have done, including our own country. People live side by side with slavery. Obviously, the big one is the Nazis in Germany. And people live side by side with the intentional killing of innocent human beings. And all of us know that those evils are terrible for everyone, not only the victims who are being killed, but also everybody else is a victim, too. And therefore, we cannot tolerate the intentional killing of any innocent human being, born or preborn, in existence at fertilization.
Well, Nellie Gray, thanks very much for speaking with us today. We know you're busy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nellie Gray is president of the March for Life, and she was with us from her office in Washington, D.C. Still with us is David Meyer, co-editor of Social Movements, Identity, Culture, and the State. And, David, we just got a piece of wire copy. 16 people were arrested in front of the federal building in downtown Los Angeles during a civil disobedience protest against the war in Iraq. The protesters were taken into custody peacefully after they and about 60 others staged an anti-war rally. What's the effect of arrests in a demonstration?
Arrests are a way to make news with a smaller number of people. Because part of the package of protest politics is getting your message out to a broader audience. This means dependence upon mass media. One way to get attention in mass media is to have a celebrity. So the coverage of the anti-war demonstration in Los Angeles all led with Martin Sheen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that Martin Sheen's analysis is necessarily any deeper than anybody else who was out there marching, but it's a face that people recognize. And newsworthy.
He's not the president, but he plays one on TV.
And, sure. And arrests can turn regular people into celebrities, and it can also become routinized if it happens over a long period of time, and then mass media can begin to ignore it.
Mm-hmm. Is the primary effect, as you say, you know, obviously the intention is to get the message out, whatever that message may be, but is the effect more on the demonstrators who realize, you know, activism could be a lonely business, and suddenly they realize, no, we're not alone. Is that the biggest effect, or is that message going out through the media?
The message is going out through the media. It's also making an issue salient to a broader audience. And it's important to recognize that politicians are understandably loath to give credit to demonstrators for influencing what they do. June 12, 1982, a million people assembled in Central Park to protest nuclear weapons. The Reagan administration had stopped arms control talks. June 14th, Caspar Weinberger, then Secretary of Defense, announced that they were resuming arms control talks. Now, some enterprising reporter intelligently asked, does this have anything to do with the demonstration 2 days ago? And Weinberger answered, it's kind of a coincidence, don't you think?
Let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Judith, who's with us from Milwaukee.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm coming to Washington this weekend. I'm going to get on a bus from Milwaukee tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. And we'll drive through the night and get there sometime on Saturday morning. We'll be there about 8 hours and get back on the bus again and head home.
A very, very long day, a long trip. What makes it worth it for you?
Well, I've never been part of any protest before, but I think I've just reached a level of frustration. I'm appalled at the mindless belligerence and the arrogance of this administration.
Mm-hmm.
And I've sent emails off to my senators and my congressmen, but somehow it feels that I need to be there.
This is an important point. It's not as though people who show up at demonstrations aren't doing other kinds of politics. People who protest are more likely to vote, more likely to work in campaigns, more likely to be involved in civic organizations locally than your standard American citizen. It's not an alternative. It's an addition to political participation.
Judith, thanks very much for the call, and maybe we'll see you on Saturday.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Here's an email we got from Bruce Wilkin in Waco, Texas. I feel that public protest is usually based on hyperbole. It utilizes songs, catchy rhymes, and chanting in unison. I prefer to make my stand by sharing my views and trying to change the minds of those who disagree through logical analysis of the issues over a dinner or a drink. What made Martin Luther King different was his powerful speeches with sound premises and logical arguments. I see this as a more effective way of communicating an idea and pushing a cause than through the grassroots than bumper stickers and T-shirts.
Different people are persuaded by different things. Again, it's not instead of. It's in addition to. Martin Luther King's speeches, when read, are not particularly well elaborated or detailed. His writing has more of the details and more of the argumentation. And Martin Luther King wasn't the only civil rights activist. There were all kinds of arguments going on at the same time. Again, it's not an alternative. It's an addition to.
And here's another email, this one from Susan Fowler. I do protest with the power of the dollar. I feel that using my money to communicate a message is far more effective than marches or demonstrations. I walk to work every day to reduce the amount I spend on gas. I don't own an SUV, wouldn't buy one. I am an animal rights activist, so I don't buy meat, any product that contains any animal product or any product tested on animals. In the past 10 years, almost all makeup companies have ceased animal testing. Burger King finally added a vegetarian burger to the menu. The power of the dollar does work.
But it wasn't only the power of the dollar in any of those cases. I mean, the Burger King example is interesting because there are several lawsuits against fast food companies now. Mm. I mean, there's more going on than just the individual consumer decision.
Let's go to Kathleen, who's with us from Athens, Ohio.
Hi, thanks for the show, Neil. I really, truly believe it's a critical and precious civil right to use the act of protesting, and it's an effective way to let our representatives and, more importantly, even than that, is the rest of the world know that there are hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. who are against this possible upcoming war in Iraq. And I also want to say that the earlier caller, I was at that October 26th march, and I interviewed many, many families, soccer moms, World War II, Vietnam, and Desert Storm vets, and grandmothers in wheelchairs. So the sound bite that you get over C-SPAN and a lot of other media coverage is often the fringe element. And from marches in the past that I've gone to, the diversity at these marches I've been to the last few years are really representative, I think, of America. And I think it's really refreshing and empowering.
So that incoherence that one caller mentioned of all these different groups with different messages, that doesn't bother you at all?
I think the piece, the connecting the dots of the issues as far as like the earlier person that you had on about protecting life, I think at the last march it was a clear message that people were there trying to protect the lives of Iraqi civilians. So I didn't find it incoherent whatsoever.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Tony Murphy. He's with the Answer Coalition, which is organizing this weekend's anti-war rally. He's with us by phone from his office here in Washington, D.C., and welcome to you.
Oh, welcome. Thank you very much.
2 days before the rally, what's it like over there in your office?
Well, this is a very busy office right now. The phones are ringing off the hook from both people who are coming in from all corners of the country to the news media, who's starting to notice that there's a bubbling up, widespread sentiment against the war is now becoming widespread action. And to weigh in on this debate, I think that one of the advantages and the purposes of having large demonstrations is that it inspires, encourages, and emboldens people who would otherwise not feel brave enough to come out against the war. Because when you watch the media, they paint a false picture of consensus behind this war. Mm. And so you have the demonstrations, and people who have anti-war feelings, who feel that they don't agree with what the president is doing, then feel that they can come out and get involved. And we're seeing a lot of examples of that. I wasn't surprised to hear the woman who called in from Milwaukee just now who said, I previously was not an activist, but now I just feel I have to do something. And when people see other people take to the streets, it makes them feel that they can do something. And it inspires people to do things that are maybe more creative and not just a demonstration or a rally. For instance, last week, British rail workers refused to move cargo that they said was going to the British Special Forces for war in Iraq. So this kind of pressure leads to things like last week when Tony Blair said maybe inspections should be given a chance to work. And his job until now has really been to support everything that the United States does.
Now, in October, the big rally then had many more people than a lot of people suspected,
right.
And by any measure, I guess on that level alone, it was a success.
Right.
What would be the measure of success come Saturday?
The measure of success come Saturday, I think, would be to see that the anti-war movement is alive and well, and to it show that it's not going away. Ultimately, obviously, the goal is to stop the war.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that, you know, I think the anti-war movement is already transforming the political climate right now. I think that it's becoming clear that Bush faces mass opposition to his war. And I think that the Bush administration was shocked by the numbers that came out on October 26th and is, in fact, racing. One of the reasons that it's racing to war now is that it fears the emergence of a large and powerful anti-war movement that can put a stop to its war plans.
Well, Tom Murphy, thanks very much for being with us. Again, we know you're busy, too.
Okay, thank you very much.
Tony Murphy is an organizer with the Answer Coalition, which is organizing this weekend's anti-war rally, and he joined us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. David Meyer, as we look at this, so we just have a minute or so left, but I wanted to ask you, it's very difficult to sustain long-term protest movements. Obviously, the pro-life movement has been rallying for 30 years now, but it's very difficult to keep the pressure growing, isn't it?
Sure, and political figures play a key role in this because President Bush has done a bad job of managing opposition to his policy. He hasn't gotten experts outside of government in line, and as long as activists are able to convince people that something wrong, that there's something wrong and their action might be able to change it, then you're going to have continued activism. And that's what the anti-abortion activists and, as a result, the abortion rights activists have done.
Mm.
They've, in fact, kept each other mobilized back and forth. I hope I'm answering your question on this.
So, too. David Meyer, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
David Meyer is a professor of sociology and political science at UC Irvine, co-editor of Social Movements, Identity, Culture, and the State. He was with us by phone from his office in Irvine. Wanted to end with this email from Brian Frank. My first protest was a pro-choice rally in Lansing, Michigan in 1989. I was a high school freshman, probably just as interested in demonstrating my political beliefs to the public as I was to the cute girl in my English class who informed me of the rally. The day before, she and I were sitting in the basement of my house making signs to wave. I was working on one that was supposed to read, pro-choice is not necessarily pro-abortion. I tried several times to make the sign, first forgetting the O in abortion and then going through several pieces of signboard trying to spell the word necessarily. When I'd finally finished the sign, my father aptly pointed out that, although interesting, the message was not quite supportive of the cause for which I was rallying. In the end, the sign was scrapped. I don't remember the protest all that well, but I've never forgotten how to spell necessarily. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.